Well, in a moment, we're going to take a walk on the strange and unusual side. Timothy Green Beckley joins us. We're going to talk about ET communications, secret space programs, Nikola Tesla, and so much more on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back. Tim Beckley with us, UFO and paranormal pioneer. Since an early age in his life, it's been more or less revolving around the paranormal. The house he was raised in, get this, was thought to be haunted. He underwent out-of-body experiences at the ripe age of six. He saw his first of three UFOs when he was about 10. And over the years, he's written more than 30 books on everything from rock music to the secret MJ-12 papers. He is now the president of Inner Light Global Communications, editor of the Conspiracy Journal, and Bizarre Bizarre. Welcome back to Coast, Timothy Green Beckley. Hey, Tim, how are you?
Well, good, George. Good to be back on you again and to be able to talk about the mysteries of the universe and perhaps reveal a few secrets if we can.
We're going to have some fun next hour. Tim Schwartz joins us with his work on Tesla, and then we'll take calls with you later on tonight. Tim, how have you been? What's new?
Well, you know, I've been very active. Even with the downturn, of course, in bookstores, we used to deal with about 4,000 bookstores direct, but now, of course, most of it is on the internet. But we keep, very busy. We have a team of very professional and established writers who are experts in various aspects of the paranormal and UFOs, and we keep bringing out new material. If there's a different angle that we haven't covered, we'll soon have something out on it and discuss it in a mature, open-minded, but non-hopefully sensationalistic manner. So I'm always busy. I do a bit of traveling when I can, and I was out in Phoenix, Tucson, actually, about a month and a half ago. Went up to Sedona, talked to some people up there who have had some remarkable experiences. That's an area that's thought to be a vortex. There's a gal up there by the name of Delacroix, who is Raven Delacroix, who is an actress. She's been in quite a few movies and on TV and all over the years, and was a dancer and very well known. And she lives on what she believes is now a vortex or a portal. And she has some very amazing photographs of what seemed to be, what I call these alter terrestrials. I don't refer to them as extraterrestrials or aliens because we really can't prove where they're from. But the photographs are amazing. There's another fellow who up there by the name of Tom Dongo, who has just scrapbooks full of the photographs that he's taken. One on a private ranch, which was owned by the Bradshaws, but was bought kind of strangely enough by the government several years ago, and now they have it fenced off so people can't get to it. But there were some amazing things kind of like a miniature version of the Skinwalker ranch.
That's right.
Some amazing photographs. And people say, well, these orbs are dust and insects and birds and things like that. Well, a lot of them are spots on the lens and open apertures and so forth. But some of them are not. And Tom Dongo has just got some amazing the photographs. So there's a lot going on that really just doesn't. If we're not talking about it on Coast to Coast or maybe a couple other internet, shows, there's really no way for people who are seeking this information to come across it unless perhaps they happen to subscribe to our Conspiracy Journal newsletter or are tapped into our Tesla Secret Lab website. So we keep busy and marching forward and trying to come make some sense out of this very strange topic. And we hope we're doing that, but it's not an easy chore, that's for sure.
No, it isn't. But there is so much going on, Tim, on this planet, in this universe, that just defies the imagination. It's just amazing, the things that are out there.
Well, and it's been going on since mankind has started keeping records.
Sure.
Of any kind. I mean, you have, of course, all kinds of markings and drawings and etchings and pictographs on the cavern walls. You have, of course, the American Native legends of the Sky People and the Chiquinas and the dolls and so forth. So there is a history of all of this, and I do believe that there's something of tremendous importance going on, but we just kind of have to get a hook on it. These intelligence, and I think there is more than one, are trying to tell us something, but they don't have, they can't pick up the telephone and call like you and I can have a conversation now for the next few hours. They have to do it in their own way, and their own way may be totally strange and alien to anything sure. that we are familiar with. They do it sometimes with flashing lights. They can do it perhaps with some telepathic communications.
Crop formations, do you think?
I beg your pardon?
Crop formations, maybe?
Well, I'm not sold on the crop formations, and the problem there, of course, is that some of them have been man-made. And I don't know. There are some crop formations or formations that I have investigated over the years, not the ones per se in England that are very sculptured and very well designed, but I remember when I first started getting involved and doing a little field investigation, that there were what we called saucer nests. They weren't quite as elaborate, or nowhere near as elaborate, as the ones that are seen and photographed from the air today. I remember there was an incident that took place in a small town in New Jersey. And somebody had called me. I think it was about maybe 16 or 17 years old at the time. And I was pretty active in this. Of course, I got started when I was around 14. Mm-hmm. I had gone out and bought a little mimeograph machine and started putting out a newsletter and pretty soon had subscribers all over the world, you know. Anyway, we went to this little town and we met the little farmer. I guess farmer, I don't know. He lived in a rural area, you know, and had a little field behind his house. But he showed us what appeared to be markings in the ground. Now, what they were is they looked like just white, kind of like white markings. You know, they weren't defined or anything, but they were kind of circular. The thing that was kind of strange about it, some people said, well, they were, you know, the markings left by a tire, a tractor tire, you know. Mm-hmm, right. But I didn't see how that was possible, because where this indention and this ring, the series of rings, was made in the soil, was back where I don't think a tractor could actually have made the circle. It would have had to have gone around a tree to do it. I mean, that's where the circle was. It seems to me, if I recall correctly, it was around the tree. And I don't know how they could have gotten to squeeze a little tractor in there. It just didn't seem like an appropriate, explanation for what was going on.
You know, so something's going on.
Yeah, I think they do attempt to communicate with us, but we don't know. We can only guess at really what they're trying to say, you know, and maybe what they're saying is only of importance to them. It's kind of just kind of hard for you to put your finger on all of this. But, you know, a couple of months ago you had Brad Steiger on. Mm-hmm. I think it was around Halloween. And he's, of course, an old friend of mine.
Right. He was on this weekend.
That's right, yeah. And we, of course, have conferred over the years. We've actually been very close, friends. We refer to each other as brother. not related, but as brother Brad and brother Tim. You know?
What a prolific researcher he is.
Well, you know, George, people ask me, they always say, how many books have I written, on UFOs and the paranormal? And I can't come up with an exact total. I know, I think we have about 279 on Amazon, but those are things that I've just worked on as a publisher and editor.
Sure.
So my standard comment is, when somebody asks me how many books I've written, I say a lot less than Brad Steiger, but a few more than Nick Redfern.
I love that.
Because he's catching up a little bit there. You know?
Well, Tim, you've been kicking around for at least 40 years researching UFOs.
I have, yes. Wow. Kicking and screaming, I would say. Yes, well, that's... I've been involved in this since I was a kid, but what I started to say there was, I think Brad told you the story about how my grandfather on my father's side of the family in Kentucky had an experience with a headless horseman.
That's right.
So that would have been, now I didn't know my grandfather, or if I did, I certainly don't remember meeting him. I would have been too young when he passed away, but he was a very religious man, a Baptist, and he didn't really want to discuss it. I think, he maybe only told my dad, once about it, and said he never wanted to speak about it again. But then I had an experience when I was around 3 or 4 years old. My parents lived in New Jersey, but every year or so, my mom, because of her asthma and all, my parents would drive down to Kentucky. In those days, it was considered the place to go if you had allergies or something. I don't think there is such a place on the planet anymore.
Not anymore.
Like that,
they used to go to Arizona, too.
Well, but they don't because people bought – I know I asked people about that. I had the worst case of hay fever I ever had in Arizona, and I asked somebody about that, and they said, well, everybody from the east, you guys bought all your plants and stuff with you.
That's right.
So
that's
right. Anyway, we were going down to Kentucky, and I think it was about a three-day drive, and my father did most of the driving, and my mother did most of the backseat driving. And, you know, they were driving one night, as I understand. I heard the story. You know, they told me several times over the years. And it was getting progressively foggy out. And my dad wanted to continue driving, though. He wanted to get there because they'd been on the road for a long time and run out of restaurants and places to stop and all that, you know. But it got worse and worse out, the weather, you know, weather-wise. And my mother insisted that they immediately stopped. So he didn't know where he had stopped, actually, because they were up in the mountains mm-hmm. somewhere, you know, and it was just so foggy they couldn't see a foot in front of him. Anyway, when the fog lifted the next morning, it turns out that they were about maybe a foot or a foot and a half from going over the side of a cliff.
Geez.
So I always say, well, if there is a protector out there or a guardian angel or whatever you want to refer to him as, I guess that was, my first inkling or one of my first inklings that maybe there are forces and energies and intelligence that we just can't comprehend, and they're watching over us, and maybe every once in a while they can offer a helping hand.
Well, in these 40 years of research, Tim, what's out there that you can say beyond a shadow of a doubt you've learned?
Well, I've had a course. Now, what you experience yourself probably stands out, in your mind, because if anybody's going to, people can tell you a story, and you can say, well, maybe they're exaggerating a little, or maybe they're, making it up or telling a tall tale. And some people do. There's no doubt in my mind that that has happened. But I would say most people are fairly sincere about their UFO experiences. It isn't anything that you want to run around telling the world, although maybe it's gotten a little bit better now because of the internet and the TV shows and so forth devoted to the subject. There isn't quite that negative stigma that there used to be. But, you know, I've seen the evidence, of course, of tons of photographs, some of which could be fake, obviously. Tons of first-person eyewitness accounts and close encounters. Now, a good friend of mine is a fellow, and I think you probably had him on the show, by the name of Ted Phillips.
Yes.
Yeah, okay. Well, now, Ted, in fact, would, I think, like to talk to you soon because he's got some vital information that he's put together on the Morley Woods, where
okay.
he's been investigating
it
now for
sure.
the last couple of years. I just spent some time with him about a month and a half or 2 months ago. And we discussed a lot of what's, going on in his life. And he's had some health issues, but he's recovering. In fact, he hopes to go on to this expedition to Czechoslovakia, where there may be something in a cave. I guess he's told that story, too. That, to me, is one of the most fascinating things, that they've discovered something that seems to be alive or active that's deep underground.
Is it like a Sasquatch?
No. No, I think this is something in a coffin-like structure.
Oh, really?
More related to like an ancient astronaut artifact.
Ah, okay.
From what I can gather, right? But Ted, of course, has collected more than 5,000 physical trace cases where these objects have actually landed and left impressions in the ground.
Right.
And they've picked up all sorts of...
Or burn marks.
Burn marks and materials and metal and taken photographs and done all this work. So to me, that his work probably validates and gives substance to this, credibility to the whole UFO subject. But, you know, interestingly enough, he met Dr. Hynek when he was a teenager or very young, maybe in his early 20s. In fact, there is a famous photograph of Dr. Hynek and a group of people, including Ted Phillips, standing behind an indention in the ground in Socorro, New Mexico, where police officer Lonnie Zamora had seen this egg-shaped object land and perhaps the two little beings get out.
A great case.
A great case. Probably one of the most credible ones on record. You know, Officer Lonnie Zamora died a couple of years ago now. I did talk to him once on the phone, but he was very reluctant.
Yeah, he didn't want to talk much about it.
No. I don't think he ever went to any conferences. He certainly didn't try to profit from his experience or anything. But in this photograph, which has been published many times in various books, including probably Brad Steiger's Project Blue Book, there's a photograph of Dr. Heineken, a group of people, and a very young Ted Phillips standing down looking at this impression on the ground in Socorro. So I said, Ted, well, had Dr. Heineck known of your work, even though, you know, when you were a youngster, and invited you to come to this, you know, to Zamora to check it out? He said, "Oh no, that's where we first met." So I don't think most people realize that, but they met in Socorro, New Mexico, and since then, of course, Dr. Heineck has passed on. But one of the things that has intrigued me about Ted, and I've kind of followed along with him in this belief, is that in the old days, almost everybody believed that UFOs were nuts and bolts. You know, they had to be flying saucers from other planets. I guess Major Kehoe, you know, who's head of the NICAP, kind of pushed this into our conscious. And for a long time, even actually the government kind of fostered this point of view. They'd rather you not believe that UFOs existed, but if you have to, then pray tell, you kind of have to go along with the party line and believe that they come from some other planet. Well, I think Ted and I and quite a few other people in the field who were amongst the nuts and bolters have now shied away from this explanation for most of the UFOs and have come to the conclusion that what we are dealing with is a lot stranger and a lot far-fetched and is probably what we would consider to be paranormal in nature.
Well, dimensional?
Well, yeah, you know, well, that's kind of a catch-all phrase, because what does that mean? It means, well, this is why I refer to them as the ultra-terrestrials. This would be anything or any intelligence or any energy that is outside of something that you can see in a physical sense. And even when you see these beings in a physical sense, and boy, they have come in all shapes and sizes and colors, they seem to have the remarkable ability to change shape in front of your eyes and disappear, you know, in seconds or just in the blink of an eye. So there's something here going on that we just can't really get our hands on. I mean, I don't think, you know, they talk about disclosure, and disclosure would be a great thing, I guess, but what do you actually disclose?
Well, and I don't think disclosure will ever come, Tim.
No. The only way that disclosure will ever come is if there is a landing on, let's say, the White House lawn, and that isn't going to happen because unless something does, you know, come down here from some other, you know, universe or some other solar system or star system or what have you. But this thing is all involved and ingrained with the history of the planet Earth. And you don't have to look, you know, far and wide for an explanation. And an explanation isn't going to be an easy thing to come upon, because if there were an explanation, I think that it would change our entire way of living in our
dramatically.
Dramatic. And who wants to rock the boat? You know, I mean, it just isn't going to happen. And I think you've had other people on the show, George, who have talked about Every type of politician discusses the subject of UFOs. Of course, there always seems to be a guffaw factor to it, but it could lose you 20% of your constituents.
Hold on, Tim. Coming back for more in a moment on Coast to Coast AM. Well, next hour, Tim Schwartz joins us. We'll talk about the lost journals of Nikola Tesla, along with Timothy Green Beckley. When we come back, let's talk about this secret space program. What might it be? That'll be next on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back. Tim Beckley with us. Tim, what do we know about a secret space program? What might be going on here?
Well, we've got quite a bit of evidence that something strange is indeed going on involving a program that seems not to be related with the official NASA program. First of all, you have all sorts of mysterious structures that have been seen and photographed on the lunar surface.
Right.
And this goes back many, many centuries. It's not something, recent. So there's a couple of possibilities here. It could be that there is a civilization, a breakaway civilization that has grown up alongside of us. Perhaps they live underground in caves. Perhaps they even have bases on the moon or on Mars. And we don't know anything officially about their existence. Or it could be, now, one of the theories is that, and this isn't so much of a theory, it actually is the case. Back in the 1920s, there was a secret society in Germany known as the Vril. And they would meet on a regular basis, and there were nine very attractive women who were mediums. And they would go into a trance, mm-hmm. and they would supposedly receive information from another realm or another dimension or from another society, and they were given the plans to build a disc-like spacecraft. Now, I have seen some of these plans, which purport to be original. They can be found on the Internet, and I've seen them in journals and so forth.
Do they look technically authentic?
Well, I'm not, again, according to whom? Certainly, I'm not a scientist. I'm a journalist. They look very much like the craft that were seen in the late 1940s and in the early 1950s. The sightings of these bell-shaped craft were very popular at the time, with the three-prong landing gear and what looked to be a dome on top with the portholes and windows. Let's say the photographs taken by George Adamski, whether they're real or not.
Right.
These looked very much like the channeled drawings that had come through this German secret society. So now, I have come up with the theory, and I don't claim that it's 100% original, but I do believe that there were a group of German scientists who were working on various projects to develop an alternative a means of propulsion, not like our rocket fuels and so forth, under a top-secret program called Project Paperclip. Over 5,000 former Nazi scientists and engineers were brought to the United States following World War
II. And the Soviet Union.
And some were sent to the Soviet Union. Uh-huh. And, of course, we all know the names of Wernher von Braun, who was the head of the early space program here, and also Professor Hermann Oberth. Now, Oberth gave many interviews in the early 1950s proclaiming that we were being visited by extraterrestrials and that flying saucers were from outer space. I do believe that the government tried to cover up with the extraterrestrial theory for the origin of flying saucers the fact that they were working or continued to work on some of these programs that the Germans had established going back to these the seances. So, again, this does get spookier than one would believe. It's just not a matter of, hey, a German scientist coming up with their own propulsion theories. It goes back to seances and channeling and automatic writing. Well, I think that instead of the government admitting that they were in a close consortium with these Nazi sympathizers, and some of them were Nazis, in fact.
No doubt.
That they would rather have everybody believe, though, that the Roswell UFO, if you're going to believe, again, it goes back to the old the saying, if you're going to believe that flying saucers are real, you should believe that they come from outer space. So I, for one, believe that some of this technology that may still be floating around here today goes back to this original plans and drawings made up by the Germans, and that the UFO crash at Roswell, if it really did happen the way people say it did, that this could have been one of these Nazi experiments. And in fact, why some of the military at the time, such as Jesse Marcel Sr., would go along or come out with statements that they were that this was like nothing on this planet, is because they were being sympathetic to the cause and didn't want people to know that we might have been in an alliance with some of these scientists, that unsavory scientific types that were brought over here. So I think that there's a good possibility that if some of these UFO crash cases did take place, that they weren't extraterrestrials, extraterrestrial vehicles, but that they were craft that it were being test flown by either a secret Nazi group still in existence or something that a secret society or a group of our own government.
Well, Tim, what about this? What if we've had societies, as Michael Cremo would say, that have been hundreds of millions of years old? If we did, is it possible that what could be those structures on the moon could have been built by us?
Well, that's a possibility too. Or it could be that that was a way station for the ancient aliens or the ancient
sure.
astronauts that were coming here. Because if you go back and you study all of the texts that exist, of course, Zachariah Sitchin's work, even the Bible talks, of course, about Ezekiel and all. There are these cavern drawings and of course, not only just American Indians, but the Indian culture itself speaks of all these different crafts and has illustrations of what seem to be flying vehicles long before, the Wright brothers flew for a few minutes, got off the ground, you know. And, of course, we also have the well-established airship flap of 1897. And most people don't realize until they start doing a little investigation into this, that in addition to the objects that were seen over Texas and California, and I think parts of New Jersey and St. Louis and all, there were sightings of mysterious aircraft, cigar-shaped vehicles and so forth, different parts of the world, including quite a flap in England, if I'm could be said corrected, but I think it was 1903. I've seen some of the photographs. In fact, we've published some of those in our book, Disclosure, which looked like these torpedo-shaped or cigar-shaped craft that have been seen and photographed and encountered by many. So this secret program, whatever you want to call it, it could be from a number of sources. They could be related and working as a consortium, or they could be just a lot of different things going on here that we can't explain. In fact, let's see, George, that's one of the problems about UFOs. UFOs can be whatever you want them to be because they are unidentified.
That's exactly right.
But also, too, that makes, that gives us a pause for some intellectual thinking that we wouldn't get otherwise. Can you imagine if there were no UFOs? What a boring planet it would be. I mean,
I wouldn't be on Ancient Aliens. My gosh.
Yes, that's right. And I wouldn't be talking to 3 billion people.
That's right.
Right now. So there you go. But it allows people to give intellectual thinking, and discuss the cosmos and unseen things that they would never have the ability to do otherwise. And people say, oh, the early contactees in the 1950s, and the stories, of course, of George Adamski and George Van Tassel. And, I met many of them, of course, and have intermingled and associated with their family members, even because most of them have now since passed on. There's very few people from the early classic days of flying saucers that are still alive. But, people say, oh, they gave the subject a bad reputation. Well, no, UFOs give itself a bad reputation. You don't have to hurt. You don't have to do anything there. But I don't think, if it wasn't for the contactees, I don't think we would have the imagination and the drive to really go into outer space ourselves.
Probably not.
I think it was maybe this intelligence or intelligences or whatever they are, maybe this is an attempt to push us ahead. There is something here. There's both the good and bad and neutral in all of this. And we have to be careful not to overstep our bounds. We have to be careful about who we are communicating or trying to make contact with. But, I have heard very many remarkable stories of people who claim to have had close encounters of one type or another. Some of it is very sinister and very spooky, and other parts of it seem to be of perhaps a higher a spiritual nature. But again, we don't know who we're dealing with, and I don't know if I'm reluctant to believe anything that any of these. It's kind of like going into a seance room, you know, and your uncle George or somebody speaks to you, and you know, outside of saying hello, and I'm here on the other side. I don't know if you naturally would, you know, go out and put your last dollar on the, you know, the roulette wheel because somebody told you to pick number 9. You know what I'm saying? And I think that's with this. We've got to take all of this with a grain of salt, not to, you know, push it aside entirely, but we've got to be careful with what our relationship is with these ultra-terrestrials, as I like to call them, until we know who we're dealing with. And if we can deal with them on equal terms, and
if that's possible.
If it's possible, it could be, and I think that this is a, you know, another explanation, is that this intelligence is so different than ours. It's kind of like us trying to interact with a, you know, a bunch of insects in an anthill. It's impossible. It'll never, you know, it'll never work. I think this intelligence is totally separate and outside the realm of anything that we can comprehend, and possibly not something that we can deal with on a strict scientific terms. You know, and this is why people say, "Oh, UFOs are best left to scientists to explore." Well, first of all, science is not very interested in this, except for a very handful of people, because it would knock them out of the box. I mean, it would just, you know, to send science for a loop. And also, they can't comprehend it because it's not what the textbooks teach, see? And I don't know, you know, what are your textbooks for something like this, you know? Like a handful of books on UFOs. So how is the president, I mean, if the president were being honest, see?
He may not even know, though, Tim.
Oh, I don't think he does. In fact, I mean, if you remember the last, Democratic debates when they were actually asked about the UFOs, mm-hmm. who was it? Dennis Kucinich was the only one, of course, who had an experience and knew something about it. Jimmy Carter and, of course, the Clintons.
They all tried to find out.
Well, yes, and they don't get very far because I don't even know who would they go to for, you know, like for the information on this. I mean, I think the government they probably have a lot more photographs than we do. They have a lot more films. But what does that prove? We've got hundreds of photographs of unknown objects in the sky, most of which seem to be able to change the luminosity. They can change speed. They can change shape. They can come and go of their own free will. So how do we explain, how does the president or anybody get on TV at a press conference and explain this? The best they could do, George, is say, listen to Coast to Coast.
That's right.
And buy one of Tim Beckley's books and make up your own mind.
I got it. Hey, let me ask you. You sent us some images that we've got at coasttocoastam.com.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
Tell me about this woman named Vivenus.
Oh, yes. Well, you know how I met Vivenus. Now, we'll talk about this. I don't know if we have too much time here.
We've got about four minutes now,
okay.
And then we'll get
right.
to Tim in
well,
next hour.
She was part of what I call the walk-ins. Now, the walk-ins are people... started out as normal people like you and I, who suddenly one day find themselves being taken over and possessed, but not in a negative term
not evil.
Not like Linda Blair and the Exorcist or something like this. These people give over their minds and their bodies freely to a more advanced intelligence. Now, I first met Vivenus on the Long John Neville show.
Gosh,
and of
that's
course, you know,
way
Long John
back.
Neville, we discussed it. In fact,
yep.
I had a quote from you in Fate magazine.
That's right.
I did an interview with Paris Lamont, who you had on the program. You know, we set up the night that WOR went live with Coast, you know. And she claimed, now, she seemed to be a very sensible woman. In fact, she was given a battery of psychological tests, and she was not weird. She was not off the wall. I mean, you can tell the types. There are people that can come into your studio. And I know you're deep underground there in St. Louis.
Well, I'm in L.A. right now.
LA, yeah, but sometimes you're deep underground.
Yes, I am.
and perhaps that's for your own, you know, your own safety there. Because, you know, people will come up to you with some pretty darn far-fetched stories. And you can usually tell, I could tell in 20 seconds or less, whether they're to be
legit or
given,
not.
to be given, some amount of time or a conversation, or just, show them out the back door or something like that. Anyway, Vivina's claim that she had landed in a spacecraft in Central Park and had taken over the body of this woman, a young woman. I guess she would have been in her mid-20s by that the time, who was addicted to drugs and was a prostitute and was having a very, very bad life and a hard time here. So she actually gave her body and her spirit over to Vivenus. Now, Vivenus went on the air and told a very enlightening story about how she had come here as a spirit from another planet, how people live on the planet Venus in another the realm in another dimension, and how they live in peace and harmony with nature and the universe and have no wars and have no need for political systems. Boy, that's something we're a long way from. And, she told a very elegant story, very, very poetic. In fact, we published her book, which is still in print, called Vivenus Starchild. I have not heard from her in many a Venusian moon or whatever. She just completely disappeared. There are these people who we refer to as walk-ins, who seem to come here and have a program of enlightenment for all of humanity. Vivenus was one of them. There are other people here who claim that they are walk-ins or have been transmigrated, I believe the word is. Tilamsing Rampa is another gentleman. In fact, we've published quite a number of his books. He passed away in 1981.
Well, how long do these walk-ins stay in the body?
Well, Vivenus was here. As far as I know, she went on a tour of the country. In fact, in the back of her book, there are newspaper clippings about wherever she traveled. She managed to, give interviews and discuss her philosophy and the philosophy of these advanced space beings, which she claimed to be. Now, remarkably enough, none of these newspaper articles ridiculed her or poo-pooed her experiences. I mean, they didn't necessarily believe, hey, she's from Venus, but they did give her the time of
sure.
day.
Well, she must have been pretty convincing.
Well, you couldn't say anything bad about the lady. I mean, she had a very straightforward story of love and peace and harmony. And
you can't knock that.
No, and that was part of the Space Brothers program that existed for many, many years. It was part and parcel of the pop UFO culture. And whether people want to, snicker at it or say that it brought, UFOs into a bad repute or what have you, it was still part of the UFO, the UFO phenomena. And the UFO phenomena is part metaphysics. It's part science, if you want to call it that or believe that it's scientific. And it's part pop culture. There's no doubt about all these movies and TV shows and everything else that is and now the internet and UFO chasers and UFO hunters. And I've just done an episode of Bill Shatner's weird, show up and that's shown on the History Channel up in Canada.
Yeah, that's right. I like that. Hold on for a second, Tim. We're going to come back with the other Tim. Your colleague, Tim Schwartz, joins us in a moment as we talk about the lost journals of Nikola Tesla, along with Timothy Green Beckley. I'm George Norrie, back in a moment on Coast to Coast AM.